kiss your lips a thousand times, and more times than I can count. I have called you mine. You have stood by me in my
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. We've added three more countries from around the world. We're about 95% there, so we hope to have within the next 12 months every single country in the world people listening. Plus, we have more people listening over the telephone than any other radio program in North America. You can listen at any day that you're out and about, not near a land-based station or an internet. Call 712-432-7231, 712-432-7231. Today, we're going to talk, of course, starting always on health and healing and empowering, because that's what people want. You couldn't believe how many people I speak with in a week, just walking around New York. And I love to walk. I walk almost every night down to Lincoln Center. Why live in New York if you can't appreciate the great culture we have here? Now, I've been all over the world, and I've never been in a country that just has the diversity of minds and culture of New York. And I appreciate it. I also appreciate all the conversations on the streets, in the stores, at the juice bar, in lectures. And more than anything else, people say this. They tune in because they want to be empowered. They want information that allows them to make healthier choices. That's why we always start with the latest. Like, for example, today, from the University College London, how to reduce depression without any medications. And then what happens when you drink those sugary sodas? Not good. University of California, San Francisco tells us that. And then ginseng, one of the most two commonly used herbs in the world. The other is Gotu-Kola. But ginseng has been used for over 5,000 years. According to Angiogenesis Weekly, it does something really good for a lot of people. We'll get to that. Curcumin boosts what? And mood? I'll tell you about that, especially if you're over 40. Curcumin can help you. And doctors warn that 80% of patients are contaminated with what at high levels? You'll learn that. Plus a lot more, including what breakfast really does for you. I'll tell you that. Then from our environmental segment today, two studies. One, ice loss sends Alaskan temperature soaring, from Alex Kirby of Climate News Network. Now, how much do you think their temperature's gone up? We were told it's dangerous. If it goes up more than 2 degrees, you won't believe how high their temperature is right now. Record-breaking temperatures at this time in Alaska. But also, there has been record-breaking temperatures for the last 30 years. Wow. I'll get into that. And we just had a major typhoon go through Japan. Okay. Not a lot of people killed. That's great. Not a lot of damage. Except the amount of radioactive water near the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant has risen to a record level after the typhoon passed through Japan last week, and specifically levels of the radioactive isotope cesium are now at 251,000 becquerels per liter. That's 300% higher than it was at its highest level. Not good. And I'll tell you why and what that means for the people living in Japan and all the fish around it. Plus today, we're going to start a series of programs. These will be once or twice a week over the next 6 months. And it's about growing poverty and inequality in America. And it'll be a talkback segment. And you'll have an opportunity to call in and share your comments and points of view. Today you're going to meet a young man, 24-year-old. I won't mention his name. He went to college, and he's been sleeping in a doorway. Early this morning, I woke him up, spoke with him, and asked would he be willing to come on the program. And he's sitting in studio with me now. I want you to see the real face of poverty and see what it means to be poor in America. Then I'm going to play you a few minutes of a program that they're actually trying to do something in a very good way, good solution. Instead of locking people up in jail because they're poor, 100 cities now do it. 100 cities in the United States, if you're poor, they can put you in jail. No crime. No, not drunkenness, drugs, nothing. Just being poor, homeless, you can go to jail. But someone decided, a prosecutor decided, this just doesn't make any sense. So they started doing something about it. Of all places, Salt Lake City. And wow, what a difference. So we'll share you with that. And then my guest in the second part of our program, from Princeton, Chris Hedges. The topic, growing poverty in America, and what kind of prophetic voice is necessary today in America's social and economic decline. That's what we have going on today. As you see, we address the needs of the progressive conscious thinker. Let's begin. University College London, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Psychiatry, says that 1 in 10 adults in the United States are suffering from depression, and they don't know how to prevent it or reduce it. But something good has been found in this study from University College: exercise. Quote, engaging in physical activity 3 times a week reduced the risk of depression by 19% among study participants. This is not the first study to suggest a link between physical activity and reduced depression. In 2013, for example, Medical News Today reported on a study published in the Cochrane Library, which also showed that exercise can reduce depression symptoms. However, the research team from the Institute for Child Health at University College London says that previous studies claiming such a link have been subject to many limitations. So they did this a little different, and here's what they found. If you just go out there and do any kind of exercise 3 days a week, you're going to be different in your biochemistry, and they are right. Here's what I support about this and where I also feel there's limitation. Good that they did this, because think of how many people are engaged in the normal course of living and meet crisis that overwhelm us, that we can't handle in the moment. All of us are subjected to multiple assaults on a regular basis, possibly personal, financial, career, environmental. Think of the people who are still not recovered, still don't have a home from Hurricane Sandy, more than 80%. Think of the people who still don't have a home or recovery from Hurricane Katrina. Did we forget about that? Recently down in New Orleans, went down to the lower Ninth Ward. 80% of the people who lost everything, nothing, zero, zip, not a scintilla has been done on their behalf. I walked up and down, because you can't drive a car down many of the streets. They're just giant potholes and trees and root systems. And it looks like a place that time forgot. But there are people there and living under incredible conditions. One house I went in, we had to go back out and I had to fix up a filter for the lens because there's no floor. Have you ever heard of being in a house where there's literally just dirt? So every step you take, it goes into the air. And I'm sure you've all been in that situation where you've looked out a window and the prism of the glass and the light coming through, the refraction of that light, caused you to be able to see a gazillion little particles of dust. Well, that's what I was seeing, because there was light coming in from different angles. And yet, here's what was interesting. The people living in this place, everything was neat, like they had all their furniture and what they had, and their clothes were cleaned and pressed, and towels. Everything was, and mind you, I just walked up and knocked on the door. They hadn't prepared for any of this. This is the way they lived. And they had adapted as best they could to a bad situation. But what was remarkable is right in their side yard, they had built an organic garden. Now, they didn't have any electricity, so they made passive solar greenhouses. And this was in February I was there. When you went in the greenhouse, it was about, well, I would say 80 degrees. Outside, it was 40 degrees. just from plastic hoops, and then they put plastic over that, and they had all these racks of fruits and seeds and sprouts growing, and they must have had 10 of these, and then they had row after row, and then they had this gigantic compost pile. I mean, I've never seen a personal compost pile this large. It was about the size of an entire lot, let's say 90 by 160, and it was about 15 foot high. That's a lot. And what did they do with it? They went around to restaurants, collected the people's garbage, and took it back, composted it, and after 3 or 4 months, then it became nice, organic, fertile soil, and then they bagged it up into like a homemade compost, and then sold it, and had a thriving market. These were all the victims of Katrina, but very few people are going to be that industrious and be that self-sufficient with no help. And when I say no help, no help. The nice thing was that I interviewed about 20 young men working there, and as one of them said, we work here because we can make some money and have food for our families, but if we weren't doing this, I'll tell you exactly what we're going to do. We're going to do drugs, because at least we can take the drugs into the more affluent areas and where the white kids buy them and use them, and that's how it is. Now, we don't think about that. We don't think about the circumstances in our society that drives the drugs or the need for people to use drugs. We simply want to criminalize it and judge them. And unless you're in my shoes and you are in that environment and you see these people who are making an effort to get out of that poverty, you can't appreciate what it's like. And I'm seeing that all over the place. So here we have these stressors, and we have things we can't control. And so we go through ups and downs. Everyone does. That does not mean that you have a brain chemical imbalance. It doesn't mean you should be labeled as bipolar. It just means this is life. The better the support system we have, the more likely we are to overcome it. But that's not profitable. So if you go out and you start doing a power walk 6 days a week, you're going to reduce your risk of depression by probably 80%. Because what you're doing when you're exercising aerobically, you're creating what are called the pleasure hormones. And these pleasure hormones, the endorphins, they give you a sense of contentment, a sense of well-being, a sense of feeling good about yourself. Now, I suggest that you do it twice a day, maybe a half hour in the morning and a half hour in the evening. And it's always good to do it vigorously. I mean, really walk as fast as you can, swing those arms, and that will be terrific for you. And that means then for about, at least 12 hours a day, your whole biochemistry is going to be positive. So that means you're going to be probably 90% less likely to be depressed because you're feeling better at the biochemical level. And that's what this City College University study is showing. If you're drinking soft drinks, the sugary time, not a good idea. According to the American Journal of Public Health, as presented by the University of California, San Francisco, quote, regular drinking high levels of sugar-sweetened soda could lead to premature aging of immune cells, leaving your body vulnerable to chronic diseases in a similar manner to the effects of smoking. Now, previous research that I've mentioned on this program associated the length of the telomeres within the white blood cells with the human lifespan, meaning the more sugar you consume, the shorter your lifespan. In addition, short telomeres have been linked with tissue damage, meaning the more stress you're under, the shorter your telomeres, the shorter your life. Stress kills. Now, what if you're stressed and then to comfort yourself during your stress, you eat comfort foods which are sugary? Now, that's two negatives. And then, you know, you're stressed. And then the third negative, which will kill you, is then you're overeating sweet foods as comfort foods because you're depressed, and then you're overweight. The three together, you die. You're going to die a lot sooner than you would otherwise. And I was just thinking about this morning, about if you understand that we live more or less 25,000 days, And by the time we're out of college, by the time we're starting into our life and taking responsibility and finding our place, we've got about, 12,000 of those days behind us. By the time you're 50, think of it this way, by the time you're 50, you have about 25 birthdays left. By the time you're 60, you have about 16 holidays left. 16 summers, 16 birthdays, 16 anniversaries. By the time you're 70, you got 7 left, if you're the average person. And then suddenly you wake up and realize, my God, I didn't realize there was a clock ticking and it's running out. The answer is yes, there was a clock ticking from the moment you were born, and depending upon what you've done, it'll run out quicker, or other things will allow it to run out a lot longer. And that's the good part of this. And I'm glad to see so many people, at least in this audience, are doing all that they can reasonably do to live a longer life. Well, the good news is that we can slow down the telomeres division, keep it long, and keep your life longer too. Remember, shorter telomeres, shorter life, longer telomeres, longer life. Sugar, short. Stress, short. Overweight, short. Diabetes, short. Heart disease, short. Toxic environments, short. Pesticides, shorten. All those create short telomeres. Meditation, yoga, exercise, quality relationships, companions, friendships, extended family, quality time with the people you love, longer telomeres, longer life. And that's what this showed. Just showed one part of it, sugary drinks. So just remember, every time you eat a drink, a sugary drink, you are shortening your lifespan. Quote from the Professor Eppel, the senior author, regular consumption of sugar-sweetened sodas might influence disease development. Not only by straining the body's metabolic control of sugars, but also through accelerated cellular aging of tissues. And finally, curcumin can boost cognition and mood in older people, older over 40. 80 milligrams a day, that's not a whole lot. I suggest closer to 500 and up. That's according to the Journal of Psychopharmacology, so take curcumin, C-U-R-C-U-M-I-N. That's the active ingredient in turmeric. But don't take turmeric because you're going to get a very little amount of curcumin, because curcumin is only one ingredient in turmeric. Take curcumin concentrated by itself, and you can have better cognition, better memory, better mood. And finally, ginseng helps reverse obesity. This is in a major study, and they said that they didn't give a lot of ginseng, but it made a big difference. You're only looking at about 100 milligrams a day. So ginseng can help reverse diabetes. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment with a short piece we're going to talk about on, well, we're going to play a little piece, then we're going to go to the studio, then we're going to go inside. Well, you know what? I'm going to give my environmental segment so we don't do this a little later. Here's the latest, too. This is from Climate News Network. Quote, scientists analyzing more than 3 decades of weather data for the Northern Alaska outpost of Barrow. By the way, for those of you who are not aware, Barrow's the furthest livable city or community in the United States. It's right up there at the Arctic Circle. And it has an astonishing 7 degrees Celsius temperature rise. Wow. Why? Because of decline in the Arctic ice sheet. Quote, if you doubt that parts of the planet really are warming, talk to residents of Barrow, the Alaskan town. In the last 34 years, the average October temperature in Barrow has risen by more than 7 degrees, an increase that on its own makes a mockery of international efforts to prevent global temperatures from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius above their pre-industrial levels. The study by scientists from the University of Alaska Fairbanks analyzed several decades of weather information. These show that temperature trends are closely linked to sea ice concentration, which have been recorded since 1979. Most striking, in that period, the average annual temperature rose 2.7 degrees, but the November increase was far higher, more than 6 degrees. In October was the most striking of all. It was 7.2 degrees higher. Well, I'm not aware of anywhere in the world where it's risen that fast. That means that they're going to have a very warm winter, and that's going to change the entire life up there of people. And finally, lots of rain brought lots of pollution and lots of radiation to all of Japan, the entire island. And, quote, additionally, materials that emit beta rays such as strontium-90, which causes bone cancer, also shattered records with a reading of 1.2 million becquerels, the utility said of the sample. Officials blame these increases on the recent typhoon, which resulted in large amounts of rainfall and injured dozens of people in Okinawa and Tokyo and Fukushima. So my suggestion is that we acknowledge the fact that we have a major, major health crisis in Japan. Instead of trying to hide it, disguise it, downplay it, or cover it up, or put reporters or scientists in jail who want to report on it, which they do now, suggest that we have an international effort to help with the problem at Fukushima and then get people as far away from there as possible. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Another in a recent spike in homeless arrests.
20% arrested this month have been homeless.
You get arrested just because you're homeless.
The typical long-term chronic homeless person was being put in jail a lot because of small petty crimes, open containers, trespassing, loitering, all those kinds of things.
Columbia, South Carolina, another city criminalizing homelessness.
Well, where are the homeless people supposed to go?
The homeless end up in the criminal justice system because there hasn't been a better alternative.
I served 3.5 years at the Utah State Prison, so I've been homeless a little over a year now. This morning, I had got out of jail, sat down like this. The officer had pulled up on his motorcycle and told me I was going to jail. This was the same officer who had just taken me to jail not even 24 hours ago.
Our homeless need long-term treatment solutions instead of just incarcerations and then put them back in the street.
Just because I don't have a car, I don't have a credit card in my pocket or change in my pocket or a home to go to, does not make me a criminal.
We did a survey here. It was about $20,000 per person per year on the street because of emergency services costs. Jail time, EMT runs, emergency room visits. And so we realized we were incurring those costs anyway. There's a much more humane and economic way in order to meet their needs.
You'd be surprised who's homeless. Most people are homeless. They are running away from problems. They are running away from, you know, drug addiction. Got molested when I was a kid, about 6 years old. Started drinking early age of 13. I couldn't deal with my problems. I've been homeless for the last 20 years.
About 10% of the homeless population were chronically homeless. A chronic homeless individual that's been homeless a year or more or four times in 3 years. A lot of mental health issues, substance abuse issues.
We decided to adopt a housing first model. Instead of asking people to change their lives before we gave them housing, we chose to give them housing along with the supportive services and then allow them to change their lives if they wanted to.
We can house them for about $7,800 per person per year for case management and rental assistance in a housing unit. 2005, in order to get into housing, you need to be clean, dry, and sober, and if you fell off the wagon, then you lost your housing and case management. Well, we weren't reducing homelessness.
In 1998, we got kicked out because I was using drugs. We went back again. It's like a routine for the last 15 years. I mean, it was hard.
Having a house is the stable base for everything. If you don't have a stable place to live, that's going to be the biggest crisis on your mind every day when you go to bed. Whereas when you're in your own home, that whole level of stress is taken away. And now you can focus on everything else that you need to focus on in your life.
But it works because we've come down 72% from our high in 2005.
Getting my housing here literally saved my life. Well, they arrested me at least 18 times. Ended up at the detox. The police brought me in there. I was pretty sad, I was shaking hard. But Ed moved me in here. I mean, I had towels up there, clean sheets, pots and pans. He brought me a big box full of canned goods. He said, well, anything you need, call me. And I looked around and I told him, I said, no, Ed, I got it from here.
We've been able to show that if you house people properly and correctly, is that it takes them out of the judicial system and the recidivism rate decreases.
It's kind of like a security place for me. I know I got a place to stay. This is a good feeling.
If I was still the homeless guy, I would have continued on and drank myself to death at this point. It's my first complete 100% sober year. And it's a good start, I feel. You know, not the end of my program, but it's a good start.
The ultimate goal is to eliminate chronic homelessness here in Utah by the year 2015. And the results here prove that that is an achievable goal.
The old approach of emergency shelters and transitional housing has been a failure. Housing First has been accepted nationally. This is the key to ending chronic homelessness.
The Casper Housing Authority is trying out a system they first saw in Salt Lake City. Staff say they've already seen success stories.
Now with the Housing First, we're much more successful in getting them housed and out of the criminal justice system and off the street and help them integrate back into society.
We're actually moving out today. It means a lot to me to have my family back where we can be by ourselves, and it does help you. If you do need to come here, everyone needs a helping hand here and there.
It is most cost effective. We can serve more people with the same amount of dollars than if we didn't do this program. But it's also the right thing to do. It just makes sense.
And Housing First, it works. And it works to get people off the street. And so what you didn't see in the short piece I just played was that the police officers are now, instead of arresting people and taking them into jail, which costs $40,000 a year to put a homeless person that has committed no crime, they're just homeless, they're poor. Instead, this is only, between $9,000 and $13,000 a year to give them a home and support. There's this whole support system goes with it, social support, psychological support, health support, some food, and then helping them train to get into a career. And so that's what we should be doing all across the United States. And especially bad are the veterans, because nobody wants the veterans. There's the homeless, and they're the homeless vets. And they're a category even worse off than a normal homeless person. The good news is we're going to start a national program. It's done, 100% done, ready. I'm just interviewing some sergeants majors to see who can run it. I only want vets to be there to help other vets. And I'll let you all know how that progresses. In studio now, we have a gentleman that I met earlier this morning sleeping on the street. I invited him here. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Do you want to tell us your first name?
Sure, Brent.
Okay. How old are you?
24.
All right. Just pull the mic right up to you, please. How long have you been homeless?
About on and off for 9 months.
All right. What are some of your skills?
I've really never had a job that I've had training for that I couldn't do just through, you know, on-site training. Like, I've been a doorman, a maintenance person, a lifeguard. I worked in a nursing home. I've done painting. Like, you know, instead of listing a skill I say I would have, I would say that there's really a few jobs that I believe I couldn't do just by...
You fixed air conditioners and heating units?
Yeah, when I first got to the city last summer, I installed air conditioners.
Where are you from?
I'm from New York City originally, but then I moved upstate, and that's
right. You don't have a family?
No.
Okay. So you don't have that support system?
No.
How many of the people out on the street that you see that I see on the Upper West Side here, how many of them do you feel are hustlers? They do have a place to stay. They're just looking to get, more often than not, drug money.
I'd say most of them, like 80 to 90%.
80 to 90%, right.
But the important thing is not all of them.
No, I've seen some who are not. But you know the routines. On the Upper West Side, we know which ones are. You know, they got the dog, they got the sign. There's a whole rap they use.
Exactly.
I didn't see you doing any of that. I asked you this morning what you were looking to do, and what did you tell me?
Basically, my plan is pretty simple. The winter's coming up, and I've been out here during the winter before, and it's a nightmare, and I'm not trying to do that again. So I know that the best thing I can do is make things happen for myself, so I'm going to try and get what I've been doing, is saving up to get a room.
How much is a room?
The cheapest I've been able to find is advertised for $125 a week.
And then you can get a co-share, and that would be half that if you got someone to share it.
Someone had told me about that, and I've never seen advertisements for it, but I've met a few people that say they've done it.
What happens when you go to the shelters?
Right now, the only shelter that, you know, I've been through a lot of agencies like HRA. I've asked the police. I've asked a lot of people, and they always refer me to the same place, which is the Bellevue's men's shelter. And it was such a horrible experience that I'll never go back there.
What happened there?
The one night during the winter, I decided to go there because it was so cold that I figured I had no choice. I woke up and my backpack was gone. Someone had tried to steal what was in my pockets because I saw my pockets were turned out. And I lost my ID and everything that I had in my bag. And besides that, the place was filthy. People were smoking crack, like, literally 30 feet away from me. The restrooms were just awful. Like, it had feces smeared in the walls. It was insane. It was like a bad movie.
And this is a city run.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and also they're overbooked now. There's not enough room if they could. There's 8 people waiting for every bed available. We've done a story on the horrors of this. And yet we have over 10 million empty office spaces that are empty, owned by the state and federal government, that could be used. That's a separate story. Do you use drugs?
No.
Okay. Or do you drink? Are you an alcoholic?
No. When I was in college, I think I drank about the same as most of my peers, but my mother was an alcoholic, so I'm really not inclined to that kind of thing.
Okay. You're just trying to get enough money to survive.
Pretty much, yeah.
You're on the West Side. Interesting what you told me. You're on the West Side for good reason.
Yeah.
And so the East Side. What happened on the East Side?
I won't mention the precinct because I don't know if I'll get in trouble for that or not, but there's a particular precinct on the East Side where I used to panhandle, and they would just harass me every chance they got. Like, every time they would see me on the street, they would pick me up, they would search me, hoping to find something they could use to arrest me. And when I had lost my ID because of the night I spent in Bellevue, they started arresting me for vagrancy. If you don't have an ID or anything like that, they can take you in. And they did during the winter time, during one of the nights where it was like negative something degrees, I had gone into an ATM vestibule just to warm up. Like, I just went in and sat down for 5 minutes just to try and warm up. And they showed up not even like 3 minutes afterwards and arrested me for trespassing, even though I told them while I was there. And it seems like every chance they get, like, there were even a few times where, you know, I'd be sleeping somewhere and they would find me and they would search me and, you know, all that. And even if I had ID or something like that at the time, they'd tell me that they had to take this one time. Sorry, let me just say, for an example, this one time I was sleeping, they showed up at 3 a.m. with a van, and they searched me, and they didn't find anything, but I did have ID at the time, so they couldn't arrest me for vagrancy. So what ended up happening is the captain said, oh, you're lucky, but still, I need to take you to either the hospital or to jail or to a shelter. And I said, well, you know, I don't want to go to any of those places right now. I just want to go back to sleep. And, you know, if you want, I'll walk out of the neighborhood. And he said, no, I have to, you know, there's a camera here. You have to come with me in the van. So he ended up driving me 5 miles to an area I was not familiar with and dropped me off in front of a shelter that was closed for the night anyway. And when I asked him, you know, why he took me all the way out there, he said, you know, because that's my other alternative was jail. So, you know, I've had terrible experiences with them. It's like, especially towards the end of the month when I feel like they need to make their quota or whatever it is, they use homeless people as a target because they know we can't really defend ourselves. We're not going to hire lawyers. And most of the time, the experience was so awful that we don't want anything to do with it. So we won't go back and complain or file complaints because we know that probably nothing will come of it. And in the end, it's always going to be their word against ours. So we're victims of them.
Did you ever feel that just being poor, you would now be looked upon as a criminal?
Absolutely. Before I became homeless, I had never, the most I had ever had interaction with police was a speeding ticket upstate once. But since I've become homeless, I've had more than half a dozen interactions with the police. And it's always homeless. It's always because I'm homeless. You know, it's always because I'm on the street or because, you know, I'm trying to get warm. It's like a circle that never ends.
Well, the circle's got a little hiccup in it because now that when they took you in for not having ID because they took you to a shelter that stole your ID, and now that you don't have it, now they arrest you, and not because you've committed a crime, that's on your record. Now see how hard it is to get a job when that's going to pop up every time you try to get a job. Have you ever been arrested? Yeah. People don't want to hire people who have been arrested. Most people don't. But that's one of the consequences, intended or not, that when you're homeless in America, being poor should not be a crime. Now, do you know how many I've done? I just finished a major film. I mentioned it to you. It's coming out in a couple of weeks. My guest in a moment is going to be in it, or is in it. We have over 150 million Americans, nearly 50% of all Americans are just at, above, or below the poverty line. And those people, if they went 1 week without a paycheck, they couldn't feed themselves. They have a house, most are underwater. They're having to work 2 and 3 jobs at minimum wage to make ends meet. So it's a larger problem that you have run into, and we're trying to find solutions for it. What I'd like for you to do is just stay out after the show, hang out outside, because maybe some of the people in this audience have some suggestions to help you. And so if any of you have ideas, like to help this gentleman, you can call our office at 6. He doesn't have a phone, doesn't have a cell phone. Call at 646-926-5422, and he'll be there. And hopefully we'll have some people who might be able to help you, all right?
Okay, thank
you.
We'll
certainly see that you get food when you need it, all right? Let's now go over and say hello to Chris Hedges. And Chris is well known to this audience and to all progressive audiences around the world. Chris is one of the leading insightful cultural critics, social and political activists. For more than 20 years, he was a foreign correspondent in war zones and conflicts, Central America, Middle East, Africa, the Balkans. And he reported for the New York Times, Christian Science Monitor. And while at the Times, he won a Pulitzer Prize in 2002 for reporting on global terrorism. And the same year, he received Amnesty International's Global Award for Human Rights Journalism. And he's taught at Columbia University, Princeton, New York University, and University of Toronto. He has a lot of noteworthy books, including Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, a hard, compelling look at the most impoverished regions in the United States that have become the what he calls the sacrifice zones for the benefit of the powerful and the wealthy. He writes a weekly column read every Monday at truthdig.com. Nice to have you with us today, Chris.
Thanks, Gary.
I would hope that most people who voted for Mr. Hope and Change, President Obama, during the 2008 and 12 election cycles will have now been cured of their savior complex, the wishful thinking that any single man or woman would be able to enter Washington or the White House and perform miracles to improve the well-being of the American population that is rapidly declining economically, socially, health-wise, and educationally. Yet when we look back at the great prophetic voices for social and economic justice, they never come out of the halls of power and wealth. At least I'm not aware of them. Rather, they are voices in the wilderness, in the trenches of the citizenry. First, what has been the lesson that every American should have learned during the presidency of Mr. Hope and Change? And why should we now realize that if anything fundamental is ever going to change in this country, it will not come from a charismatic personality or slick orator in Washington, nor the corporate establishment?
Well, the lesson they should have learned is that there is no way within this political system to vote against the interests of Goldman Sachs. It doesn't matter whether Bush is president or Barack Obama is president or Hillary is president or, my God, they're trying to resurrect Mitt Romney, of all people. It doesn't matter. We have, as John Ralston Saul correctly points out, undergone this corporate coup d'etat. And I think, actually, the interview you just did with your previous guest is important. Because what it does is show how the legal system and the policing system itself has become an instrument of repression against the vulnerable. Nobody's going down towards Wall Street and arresting people who have committed fraud, documented fraud, to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. They're harassing unemployed, homeless young men who are victims of this corporate coup d'etat. That's important to remember. It's the manufacturing, the flight of manufacturing, the breaking of labor unions, all of this was orchestrated. And now the victims of this assault are somehow being criminalized for something that they not only didn't support, but had no role in implementing. And Matt Taibbi's new book, Divide, American Injustice and the Age of the Wealth Gap, does a really good job of explaining this two-tiered legal system, because at the top, these corporations, they write their own regulations and they write their own laws. And they can carry out, and they are carrying out, massive criminal activity with utter impunity. And all of the resources of the state are being directed at the victims of these global financial speculators who have seized political power, judicial power, control the press. So I think actually the discussion that preceded mine is quite relevant, because if you're a person who lives in a marginal community or you're struggling, you know very well that the state is basically omnipotent. It can do anything it wants. I mean, we have vans circling poor neighborhoods night and day in New York City while police fulfill their quotas. We have undocumented workers who are seized and slapped with incredibly draconian fines to the tunes of hundreds, sometimes thousands of dollars before they're deported. I mean, it is a vampire-like system that increasingly subjugates and feeds off of the blood of the dispossessed, while the oligarchic class amasses and accrues to itself disproportionate wealth beyond anything that we've seen within the United States, including in that sort of age of unregulated capitalism that preceded the Great Depression.
The masses don't have the wealth and influence for revolt against the rich, as in past historical times, and especially with weapons and rapid mobility and technology and vast networks of human drone, massive surveillance, and militarized police willing to serve the forces of the wealth. Therefore, what kind of a revolt would be effective against this power base in the United States?
It requires two elements. one element which frightens me, but I think it is a prerequisite for effective revolt, and that is a class of professional revolutionaries. And I have just gone back and read a lot of Lenin, and I'm not, you know, a supporter of Lenin's Bolshevism or the state capitalism that he imposed. And, of course, once he took power, which he did through an armed putsch, a coup d'etat, in essence, he carried out ruthless state terror, I mean, destroying the anarchists in particular. And yet, he was brilliant in terms of dissecting the mechanisms by which revolution can be successfully carried out. And one of the key to those mechanisms was creating an inner core of a professional revolutionary class that understood power. We can't effectively fight power if we don't understand it. And this has been one of the great failings of the liberal class in the United States, is that it didn't understand power and therefore could not respond to corporate power, to this slow coup d'etat that corporations have carried out, eviscerating our most important constitutional rights, rendering democratic institutions that once made incremental and piecemeal reform possible hollow, whether that's electoral politics, the press, labor, anything else. And then we need mass movements, sustained mass movements, that will draw large numbers of people into the streets, that is willing to carry out repeated acts of civil disobedience, to discredit, physically discredit, because I think the power lead is low. You mean, look at the approval rating for Congress, I think it's like 9%. I mean, the support isn't there, but physically, in a kind of visible way, discredit the corporate oligarchy that has seized control. And I think in conjunction with that, and this is something that you talk a lot about, we also need to build parallel systems in terms of food, in terms of small groups that actually practice direct democracy. This is, I think, was one of the assets of the Occupy movement. We need to sever ourselves financially from corporate capitalism. 70% of the U.S. economy is based on consumption, and most of it extremely wasteful consumption. There are interlocking pieces. But that is the only way we are going to affect radical change. And given what's happening to the climate, we don't have very much time left. I mean, climate change is now an inevitability. And I think we could even say catastrophic climate change is an inevitability. But if we don't react fast, and if we don't react, by radically altering our relationship to the ecosystem as well as to each other, then I think we really can seriously begin to discuss the possibility of the extinction of the human species. I mean, so we are living in, absolutely terrifying and critical moment in human history. And these forces, and the airwaves are awash in very effective electronic hallucinations and lies, it has essentially rendered us passive at a time when, our very survival is at stake.
I would agree. Thank you very much. Also, congratulations on your being ordained.
Oh, thanks.
And I know that you believe, and I certainly believe, that religion can play a role in the protest movement for economic and social justice, and we're looking forward to that day happening as well.
Yeah, I come out of that radical anarcho-Christian Dorothy Day tradition, and one that I'm still deeply rooted in, and the great liberation theologian James Cone preached. It was an inner-city church filled with family members of those I teach in a prison and have for many years, but many of those family members were there, and I was really ordained to continue to do that work within the prisons because of the gross injustice of mass incarceration that has been visited in particular on poor people of color in this country, and I think, as Michelle Alexander in her great book points out, is really the new Jim Crow, the new form of institutional racism instituted through you know, economics going right back to the corporate coup d'etat. So, you know, I think that tradition, that radical tradition of the Berrigans, is one that I hold up and I think should have a place in our struggle for significant and radical social change.
Thank you very much, Chris. Look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you, Gary.
Chris Hedges from Princeton, New Jersey, author of Days of Destruction. You mentioned something this morning. People never think about where do you go and clean up. I asked you, when was the last time you showered? How long has it been?
This is pretty embarrassing to say, but I haven't taken a proper shower in probably like 2 months. The best I can really do is I go to like Starbucks and McDonald's and I use the sink and stuff like that.
Okay. Well, today we're going to get you a shower.
I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Some clothes. Luann.
Hello, Gary. I just wanted to make a quick announcement that I am interviewing for people who are interested in attending your 12-week brain health support group, which will be starting the first week of November. So if you have any issues where you want to maximize your brain health, if you have things like Parkinson's, MS, beginnings of Alzheimer's or dementia or depression or anxiety issues, and you want to see what you can do to help yourself, this may be for you. I will tell everyone, though, that every single person is going to need a letter from their medical doctor or their psychiatrist specifying what imbalance they have, because this will be a formal study. It will be historic. And we're very excited about getting this off the ground. So if anyone is interested in being a part of it, I want them to give me a call at my home office. If you get my answering machine, don't worry. I will contact everybody back. My number is 631-504-6198. Again, 631-504-6198.
Thank you, Luann. And let's keep in mind that the last time this was held, which is about 5 years ago, and it was took almost 16 months, we saw people reverse Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and multiple sclerosis. But not enough did, because it was a tiny group. But the fact that they did was in autism. So this time we're going to have higher numbers. It'll be full, and I'll be there. It'll be for 12 straight weeks. You got to come every week for about a three-hour meeting, and then we're going to show what is possible and then share that. The 10 states where foreclosures are soaring. And it's important you know where the housing market is really getting creamed and where people are losing their homes. Number one in America, actually two, they're tied, North Carolina and Oregon, followed by New Jersey. Now, historically, North Carolina, Oregon, and New Jersey were all thought to be go-to places. And they were. Not now. And New York, right up there. Oklahoma and New York are tied. Connecticut is right behind them. Colorado is right behind them. And then a big drop down, Alabama. Low down is Texas. So not good for people who are homeowners. Property value is dropping. Anyhow, we're coming up to the end of the show. I want to thank you all for listening on our lands-based stations. We look forward to sharing more on our next program. Let's see if Utrice Lead is in the house. Come on in, Utrice, and join us. And Utrice is in New York because she's doing a series of lectures. And she just had a sold-out lecture over in Brooklyn. And she's going to be doing one next week here. We won't announce it until Monday, but there'll be an opportunity for those in the audience who want to come and hear Utrice talk next Saturday. Hi, Utrice.
Hi, Gary.
What have been the themes of your talks?
Well, the first one was reclaim, rebuild, rebound. And that is how to reclaim these our communities and rebuild them and reconstruct them and save our families and ourselves.
Good. Well, the very thing we're talking about.
Yeah, that's what we were talking about.
I don't know
about.
If you heard today's show.
I listened to a good portion of it.
They started out in Salt Lake City, and they tried an experiment. One of the detectives just did an analysis to see how much does it cost to take a homeless person and put them in jail in a year, how many times they're in and out. And it was over $40,000 with no help. Then they found that what would it cost if we got them housing where they had their own apartment or house and provided them with social services. And they found it was very inexpensive. It was only running around $12,000 a year. Plus, the person was then no longer homeless.
Right.
And therefore, the needs for drugs or alcohol dropped tremendously. So then that was picked up by a group in Oregon, and now they're having success. In fact, one police officer in the film, you couldn't see it when you were hearing the audio, but he's driving down a street, and he said they showed a picture of this street just years before where drug addiction was on every corner. It was out in the open. It was so rampant. And then today, the people have all been given homes and are in recovery. So then it focused upon all the people who had been addicts but now are in recovery. And part of the reason was they didn't have a place to sleep at night. One woman, that she took us into the woods to show her little pup tent, and that's where she had lived for 2 years. And then she would, in order to support herself, she would prostitute herself, that she'd get drugs. And now she's got a regular job. She's clean and sober, and she has a little house.
Well, of course, I mean, these things are common sense when you think about it, but the political agendas are such that, I mean, you look at Detroit. Detroit is a perfect example, and this is one of the reasons. Newark, Detroit, other cities where they're systematically being emptied, and the undesirables are gotten rid of, that is the poor. And the community, suddenly there's an influx and availability of money to revamp them and rebuild them and re-engineer them for a whole new population that had nothing to do with the construction of community.
But first they're privatizing the whole areas.
It's just amazing what's going on.
In large black pools. Mm-hmm. A black pool is where you don't know who the investors are, but it's generally syndicate funds. They bring in a lot of money. They buy up whole neighborhoods. They work with politicians to get tax defers for 10, 20 years. They don't pay any taxes on whatever they put in that area. And then they gentrify it. And suddenly you have these oases, but the people all had to be thrown out.
That's exactly what's going on, especially in African-American and Latino communities all across the nation. So this is part of an attempt to get people to understand that they have to take a stand and they have to fight for their neighborhoods and reclaim their neighborhoods and rebuild them. So,
by the way, I'm going to be taking a water tanker into Detroit starting in a couple weeks to...
Great.
Get them water into water. We even form water cooperatives to help them. I can take them back.
Imagine that. In 2014, and Detroit is sitting on one of the largest reservoirs of fresh water in the world, and 150,000 households don't have running water. And this does not constitute a major public health crisis as far as they're concerned.
Ebola does, but no water to 50,000 homes doesn't. You're right.
Unbelievable.
Eutrice Lead, in a moment, let's just say hello to Randy, who's been hanging on from New Jersey. Hi, Randy.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Good.
Peace and blessings to you and your audience. Peace and blessings to you, Sister Latrice, and to the brother that you had on the air who was out on the street. What I really want to say is that the culmination of all of the efforts of everyone, including that brother that was speaking on the air, is coming together. I think that it's crystallizing around truth. And that in itself will galvanize the movement of people who are serious about these issues so that we no longer talk about these other things and put energy into it. I think that's part of the deception, because the forces that don't want to submit to truth, that everything is whole and connected, and that the illusion of division is just that.
Randy, we're out of time. I appreciate your input. Eutrice Lead, right now, please stay with us.